Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon. And this is episode 21-17, the 17th episode of 2021. You're listening to the voice of freedom behind enemy lines here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, trying to equip you, the patriots, with the information you need to stay in the fight for your liberty. And we are in a fight. If you just stumbled across this podcast and you want to know how to listen, I think one of the best ways is Podbean, but you can also find it on Stitcher and several other podcast apps. Just search for Radio Free Virginia or Radio Free VA on some of them. You can find out more information about the show at radiofreevirginia.com. And yes, I'm still working on merch, so I will update you hopefully shortly on that front. I'm going to be talking about a few different things in this episode. First, let me tell you about our show sponsor. It's ActiCare. ActiCare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Their website is actikare.com/blue-ridge. And you should get in touch with John and his team, and they will point you in the right direction, see if they can help you. They're located in Bedford, Smith Mountain Lake, Campbell, Lynchburg, out in the country, Roanoke. So get in touch with them at actikare.com/blue-ridge. I'm going to be reading the rest of the chapter I started last week of I Led Three Lives. As well, I have a little story here that I found on Western Rifle Shooters. And it's actually over at ncc-1776.org. And the title is A New Berry Bush for the Garden by Paul Bonneau. And it says it's attributed to L. Neil Smith's The Libertarian Enterprise. I don't know what that means. Someone was pounding on the door, making a terrible racket. Old Jack made haste to open it up. I'm here to inventory and collect your guns, according to the recent National Security Order 2015-142. Apparently, you failed to take them down to the collection depot. The big, overweight stooge flipped a badge out and flipped it back in a broad manner, putting it into his pocket before Jack could get a look at it. He pushed his way into the house and Jack hurriedly got out of the way, protesting feebly. He followed the man into the living room and sat down on the couch. Well, I used to have some guns, but... The agent interrupted him. But you lost them in a boating accident. Yeah, I've heard that before many times. Do you realize that if we search your house and find one gun, catching you in a lie, you're already going to be serving time? And at your age, you may die in a cage. So don't even start with me. We don't know exactly what guns you have, but we know you have a fair amount due to the number of Nix checks. And we have a fair guess what they are, unless you've been doing some trading. And no, we didn't erase that background check data as the law prescribed. Only a fool would believe such a thing. So start getting your guns out and piling them on the table. The agent started examining Jill's items on the coffee table. He looked up and said, Well, snap to it, and have your wife get me a cup of coffee. Jack stopped for a minute and then said, Do you have a valid search warrant? Don't test my patience, idiot. That nonsense is done for as long as the national security emergency continues. The fat slob was clearly enjoying himself. Jack heard a noise behind him. Stand aside, Jack, Jill said calmly. He hurriedly moved to the right just as he saw the agent's eyes grow round and shortly thereafter heard a boom, boom of her double-barreled 20-gauge. Sorry, there's no coffee on the burner right now, she said. As the agent was expressing his death rattle, Jill cursed. This is going to ruin my favorite couch. Quick, Jack, go get that big piece of plastic out of the garage. Let's get him onto it and out of here before he makes too much of a mess. Jack, his ears ringing, hurried to comply. As he came back in, he complained, Now my tinnitus will get worse. She responded, Be happy I didn't use the 308. Come on, let's get this pig off the couch. They rolled him off while wrinkling their noses at the quickly worsening smell. I'll go get the Lysol, I hope I don't lose my favorite couch. I guess the stray shot holes will make it look a bit more antique-like. Or maybe I can glue them, she fussed. Together they managed to slide the heavy agent on the plastic over the rug to the door. But once he was on the patio, it got a lot more difficult. Go find that Richards boy who's taken a liking to you. He's got some muscles now. Drag this pig over to the deepest hole you had dug with that rent-a-backhoe last week. I'll get a nice blueberry bush to put on top of him and make some pies when it starts producing. Jack hurried off with images of steaming pies in his head. Jill started cleaning the couch and grumbling over it. Jack came back with Bob Richards, whose eyes grew round when he saw what was up. Jack mumbled that he was just a BATFE pig who had gotten in over his head, and that he needed help to bring the pig to his final resting place. Well, you guys are more serious than I guessed, taking out one of these guys on your own, at your age too. Bob, a teen, naturally thought of people in their 60s as ancient and fragile. Let's see if we can get him on the garden cart. Over many minutes, they tried this and that eventually, got Mr. Government Enforcer deposited at the bottom of the deepest hole. Bob enthusiastically started throwing dirt onto him while Jack staggered off, holding his chest and collapsed in the lawn chair. Jill finally came out, finished with scrubbing the couch. Bob, have you heard about any more lowlifes like this one working around here? Bob nodded. Some of the guys at the school were following a couple of them around, jeering and cussing at them until they pulled their pistols out. Jack and Jill looked at each other, horrified. Oh no, we buried his gun with him, Jack noted. Well, if it was a Glock, it should last pretty well down there, but it won't be much fun retrieving it if we need it. He wrinkled his nose. Jill gave a small erp just at the thought, looking a little green about the gills. She said, I'm going for a walk. If I see any more of these guys hanging around our neighborhood. She seemed anxious to get away for a while. Bring them back to look at my guns if you find any, Jack encouraged. I'll be ready for him this time. Bob, you better get your butt out of here. I wiped down any prints, although you did put gloves on right away, right? Bob took off with Jack's parting admonition in his ears. Keep your trap shut, as we talked about earlier. Sometime later, Jack had napped and rested from his ordeal and heard Jill at the front door. He jumped up, but she said, Relax, I couldn't find any just now. We'll just have to wait to increase our selection of government thugs. Jack commiserated with her. They both hoped to bag a few more before they ran out of them, as they expected to do shortly. However, she was happy to display a small blueberry plant she had caged from a gardening friend for the new mound out back. The autumn of their lives had gotten a lot more exciting since the government had obligingly banned all firearms for some imagined emergency or other. They were so thankful to the current administration for this unexpected boon. They were up every night making new plans and working out ideas for the weeks to come. It didn't hurt that at their age, they didn't have much to fear and didn't much care. Patriots, you ought to start thinking about what's to come. And I don't want to hear any more silly things. Like, I lost those in a boating accident. Because while it's a funny joke to say, hiding your guns is not what you need to be doing with them when the day comes that they're banging on your door to take them. As this story perfectly, I think, illustrates. Communists are evil, and evil must be fought. I hear so many times in conversations with people about the times that we live in. And they say things like, well, you know, you just got to let go and let God, and other cliches of that sort. There is a time when God is calling you to stand up and fight. Psalm 144 says, He trains my fingers for battle and my hands for war. And he very well could send meteors down and slay all the communists for us. Problem solved. Thanks, God. And I would be thrilled with that. That would be fine by me. Oh, their house got hit with a meteor. I never knew they were communists. But it's a rare, rare thing throughout the history of man that God does that sort of level of destruction. Typically, he's using his people to fight. Now, am I saying that the fight we're in is some holy crusade or anything like that? No, I'm not. But I do want you to think about and pray about the fact that what is the point at which you're going to fight? And I mean, I don't mean some nebulous fight. I'm in the fight because I'm voting or I'm on Facebook or whatever. I'm talking fight with your hands for your life. You need to process that thought. What is the thing that is going to put your feet in motion here with this problem that we face? Look at the countries that have just been decimated by communists. Look at Zimbabwe. South Africa is in the midst of it right now. Look at all the South American countries that have people that they're sending their kids up here alone to come to America because their hellhole of a country has been overrun by communist thugs. Look at Venezuela for a modern recent example. And look at the subjugation and the slave labor and the suffering of the Chinese people and the genocide that they're doing upon the Uyghurs. You know, we're called to fight evil. We're called to stand up against it. And at the moment, the evil that we're facing, the vehicle by which evil is moving forward, like a freight train down the tracks, at the moment, that's communism. More recently, it was Islam, but now they've got a strange partnership going on. But in either case, evil must be stopped. Evil must be fought. We are called to stand for truth and stand up against evil. And sometimes that means fighting. We've been very fortunate in America that up until recently, that fight was contained into words, into courtrooms, into ballot boxes. Now, all three of those options are pretty much gone. And there's some work to try and undo some of that, and I'm praying and hoping that that works. But I'm not hopeful that it's going to work. Because as we're going to read about in a little bit here, I Led Three Lives, they're everywhere. Not some red scare everywhere. Oh my gosh, there's a communist hiding behind every tree. But everywhere. I would encourage you, if you haven't listened to the other episodes that have this book, I've got in my show notes now. I have when the stuff is in my shows. If you want to skip ahead just to that, go listen to I Led Three Lives, chapter by chapter, and you'll see we're fighting the same enemy. And one of the first steps that he does, that enemy comes in, disarms the people. Then there is nothing to stop them. Tell the Canadians that they can get up and do whatever they want because they can't. Tell the Brits and the Aussies and the people of New Zealand that they can just live their lives because they can't. And when the day comes that China says, it's go time, those nations, there's nothing they can do. The people themselves have no ability to defend themselves. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We don't have a free state if we don't have arms. It's just simple as that. And your Second Amendment right exists for one purpose, and that is to shoot tyrants in the face. So I'll move on now. But think about that. Where's your line? And are you going to tell your husband or wife to get out of the way when that person is there? Yeah, there'll be consequences. There will. But tyrants and the agents of tyranny should be fought. And that day is shortly approaching. I really believe that. They're coming for you. And no one is coming to save you. You're the one. You're the very method of securing your own liberty. You. So get ready. Next, I'm going to talk just a couple different things from the Ford Observer's early warning update here. And this one This one I'm actually seeing here in real time. So it's about shipping. Facing a backlog of 10 to 13 days at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, shipping giant Hapag-Lloyd is suspending all new bookings from Latin America coming into the United States. Notable South American exports to the U.S. include vehicles, fruits and vegetables, coffee, and sugar. Meanwhile, volume of shipping demand continues to swamp major hubs like Memphis, Chicago, and Dallas. Industry analysts expect a shortage of truck drivers to result in some disruption through the end of 2021. This is leading to continued but limited supply chain disruption, largely in the form of shipping delays, higher wait times for U.S. manufacturing, lower consumer selection, and all-around higher prices. Some things, there's a lot of solutions to this problem, but one of the big problems is a lot of this is backlog. So this shipping backlog that we have is created by a ordering backlog, and now it's being fulfilled. So these things coming from China and from various other countries that were all shut down, that shutdowns are ending, and these lockdowns are breaking and whatever, and abracadabra, we've got a vaccine, so it's all good now, right? The virus that has a 99.99% survival rate, we can now live our lives again. So all of this shipping backlog, you're seeing all of these items, whatever they are, toys, lawnmowers, all this junk that comes from foreign countries. Well, it's all coming here on ships. And these ships, there's hundreds of them sitting off of the coast in various places. They can't get in. They can't unload. And then on top of that, we have a just-in-time ordering kind of a mentality here. And so those items, they get off the ship and they get in a truck and then they get taken to wherever they're going to go. And there's not enough truck drivers. There's not enough trailers to put the stuff in. So all these things are going on at the moment. And we can only pack so much stuff and so high at the ports before it's supposed to get on a truck or on a rail and get the heck out of there. So this is going to create problems everywhere. And I'm seeing it. I order a lot of stuff online. I try not to order stuff direct from China. I would much rather buy it at the store, and even if it's made in China, buy it and support a local business, but those local businesses almost never have what I need. So I order a lot of things online. And anything that's coming from the West Coast, California, Washington, Oregon, anything coming from the West Coast is so slow. I ordered some stuff from California. I try actually, when I'm buying stuff, knowing that this is a problem, I try not to buy stuff. But this particular item, I couldn't get anywhere else. So I ordered it. I ordered it on the 11th. It just showed up today. That's over 2 weeks. They had it in stock and it shipped out on the 16th. So 11, that's 5 days it took for them to actually put it in a box. So we're all seeing it. We're all seeing the shipping issues. And this is why you're seeing some of it. So much stuff. Almost nothing is made in America. And those few things that are made in America are being made slower because why? Well, the raw materials aren't getting here as fast. So as things open back up, you're going to see more and more of this. As people go back to work and stop living on the dole and are making more money, they will have more money to buy things, and those things will get bought and go away, and somewhat life will return back to normal. So now I'm looking at the governor's website for Virginia, and it says, coronavirus COVID-19 response. Have you downloaded COVIDwise, Virginia's COVID-19 exposure notification app? Add your phone to the fight here for up-to-date information, assistance, and resources from across state government. Click here. Oh, I don't think so. And now we're really ramping up the vaccinate everybody thing, right?
I want to encourage everyone who can get vaccinated to get vaccinated. Here's me talking in smart ways and saying smart things.
So April 22nd, 2021, Governor Ralph Northam, Blackface Northam, today announced that sports and entertainment venues in Virginia may begin to operate with expanded capacity. Well, thank you, my lord. Only a little over a year later, and social gathering limits will increase beginning Saturday, May 15th. The announcement comes as vaccinations continue to rise in the Commonwealth, and more than half of all adults have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. And now there's a typo here. All Virginians age 16 and older are now eligible for the vaccine.
Durr, I can't write. I'm only like the most important, powerful person in the whole state, and I have morons working for me who can't even write without screwing up. How fantastic is that?
This is ridiculous. I mean, seriously, this is ridiculous. Let me ask you a question. I sure hope you're not getting the vaccine. There's a great website, No Jab For Me. Lots of data there. But all that to say, so this virus has a 99.99% survival rate for most people. And that's the category 60 and up. So that means that people below that have an even higher survival rate. And age 16, let's just say age 21 and under, you have a better chance of dying from an infection, from getting a cat scratch or something on your arm, than you do dying from this virus. And that's, hey, let's just keep everything, you know, sort of shut down here, right? Let's keep doing this. And it's so frustrating. You know, my church is completely open and back to normal now. Full seating, everybody there. It was awesome. But the sad thing was, as I was walking out, I noticed there were several young people, specifically girls, but there were some boys, but several young people that were all wearing masks as they walked out of the church. They weren't wearing them when they sat there. But they were wearing masks, and I'm just thinking about the fear that we've instilled in an entire generation of people. What is happening? What are we doing? You can only mitigate risk so much. Every single one of us has an appointment with destiny, with death. That appointment is fixed. It's a fixed point in time in our future. And there's not a darn thing we can do to change that. Whether it's a car accident or cancer or whatever, there's nothing you can do to change that. If God's calling you to that appointment, you're gonna go. And we're instilling all this fear in these young people and saying, you know, that you can actually mitigate that kind of risk, which isn't a risk. So there are times when you look at things and say, okay, what is the best course of action here? And I know that sounds like a contradiction. I'm saying, hey, don't worry about it. You got an appointment to keep. Yeah. But it doesn't mean I go, you know, roll around in a pit of cobras. It doesn't mean I go jump in the tiger's cage and go play around with little tigers. If there's something dangerous, you try and make an effort to avoid that dangerous thing, unless you're just a complete idiot. But that's not what this is. This thing is a non-thing. Some of you have had it. I'm convinced I have had it. Last year, back in March. And we're instilling this fear. Well, let's look at an organization that I've been involved with for a while. Let's look at the Civil Air Patrol. Civil Air Patrol has a thing called operational risk management. And we do a lot of safety-driven stuff. And we make decisions based on, can we do this thing safely? Statistically, a lot of the stuff we do with the cadets and as senior members is extremely dangerous in the realm of, you know, what things that are dangerous. You know, we're flying airplanes. We are on the flight line with airplanes, with spinning propellers. We are working in emergency situations and climbing through woods to rescue people and searching unknown terrain for people. Do rock climbing and rappelling. We do a lot of stuff that, you know, a big obstacle, you know, we go do stuff over at the military base at Fort Pickett, you know, the assault course. And we do a lot of really cool stuff, and every single one of these things is more dangerous than this dumb virus, statistically. Yet, hey, let's shut everything down. What message does that send to these young cadets who we're trying to teach to be future leaders in this country and warriors? That they go off into the military and the military says, no, we can't do that today because, you know, there's a virus that has a 99.99% survival rate. But hey, we're going to do jumping out of planes later. But hey, we've got next week, we've got parachute training. We're going to be throwing you out of an airplane. Wait, that's way more dangerous. The guys die all the time doing that. Yeah, but it's not the virus. I mean, for goodness sakes. And it's just it's weak wimps that are making these decisions. These are the same weak wimps saying it's okay, to have trans this and gay that. Oh, you know, never mind that affects military readiness. Hey, we're going to keep on doing that. You're all fed up with this. I'm fed up with this. But yet, hey, everywhere I go, snap your fingers, I can count on the fact that there'll be a ton of people wearing masks and complying, even though, hey, there's no reason to comply.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
So now we continue the saga of Herb Philbrick as he is approaching the trial. And there's a lot of back and forth happening right now, as you heard from the last half of this chapter, last week's episode. And he continues to go to New York and be interviewed, and they're getting more information of kind of clarifying stuff that he's brought in over the years, and the trial is about to start. And so the communists are freaking out. There's this thing called the Smith Act. This is what these men are being tried under. And they are doing their very best everywhere they can across the country to rail and denounce this overreach by the government. So let's continue. Chapter 18. Don Richards impressed upon me the necessity of establishing a cover for my activities. There was always the possibility that I would encounter someone en route who would become inquisitive about my mission. I had to have a ready explanation for it, and a timely occurrence gave me one that was plausible. A group of government attorneys, one of whom was named Frank Gordon, had successfully prosecuted an antitrust case against the Big Five motion picture companies, including Paramount Pictures. A consent decree was won by the government in the case, with the result that M&P Theaters was broken up. An offshoot company, American Theaters, was formed, and I joined it as an assistant advertising director. But I let it be known that I wasn't happy about it, and I dropped a hint in the pro group that I was in disfavor with the company because of my activities in the Progressive Party and the hysteria over the Hollywood Red Hunt. The news spread through the party that I, ostensibly a non-communist, was threatened with the loss of my job for political activity. This not only created sympathy for my cause, but also served as a tailor-made cover. If anyone should ask me why I was shuttling to New York and back, I could simply say I was job hunting. Don checked with me frequently to see that all of my movements were carefully screened. He told me that if I went on the stand, I would be an important link in the government's chain of evidence, and he wanted to run no risks with me. My regular, or rather my irregular, mode of living over the years helped me to cover my trail from any prying eyes. For a long time, I had practiced subterfuges to avoid detection as a member of the Communist Party and to escape any suspicion of FBI liaison. The pattern of life, which had become second nature, made it difficult for any investigators to keep track of me. Now I concentrated more than ever on variations of this pattern. My telephone number was unlisted, and few even realized that I had one, so there was little chance of surprise checkups at odd hours to see if I were at home. I rarely took the same train, to or from the office on successive days. My lunch hours never followed a regular schedule. I usually decided purely on impulse, where and when I would eat, if at all. It had always been normal for me to devote my weekends to freelance advertising jobs, to church work, or to some other activity. So there was no irregularity in my working long hours on Saturdays and Sundays now. Occasionally, the shift in my attitudes had been abrupt. After one all-day conference in New York, going over the details of the case against the Communist Party leadership, I hopped a plane to Logan Airport in Boston, and less than 2 hours later, I was at dinner with a member of my pro-group cell. The subject of our discussion at the table afterwards was the planning of methods to raise additional money for the defense of the 12. I continued to file regular reports by secret communication methods to the FBI. The transmission of these reports was carefully guarded. Among the organizations on which I reported was the Boston School for Marxist Studies. During the winter months, the Educational Commission received a directive from National Headquarters ordering the selection of a few comrades for a course of advanced training in Marxism to offset what they called the increased tendency toward fascism throughout the United States. Vanguard leaders, the directive said, must be ready for action. The result was the establishment of the Boston School for Marxist Studies. Only party members with carefully tested backgrounds were to attend. Boone Shermer sent the outline material for the courses in the new school to me for preparation. I was to write a series of 4-page circulars for the 4 different classes to be held. I worked on the material at my office and transmitted it to the party headquarters via the parcel lockers in the Boylston Street subway. But something went wrong. A few of the circulars were routed for distribution through the Progressive Bookshop. Frank Collier placed them on the lower shelf at the rear of the shop. Among his frequent customers at this time was Cornelius Dalton of the Boston Traveler. Dalton snatched a copy of my mimeograph folder and hustled it away to his office. There he read it and learned that a series of Communist Party study classes was to be held at the Ritz Plaza halls, at which students would pursue the same kind of Marxist-Leninist studies which had brought conspiracy charges against the 12. He broke the story in his paper, and it caused an immediate public uproar, which forced the management of the Ritz Plaza halls to cancel rental of its quarters to the party. Plans for the Boston School for Marxist Studies were hurriedly revised, and the courses were postponed until new arrangements could be made. As a result of Dalton's exposé, the school was now cloaked in secrecy that was almost absurd. I tried to get into the labor class, which I knew would be the most interesting and revealing course of study, but this was denied me. So skittish was the party over the secrecy of the school that I had difficulty finding out where my first class was to be held. I called the district headquarters, but the girl told me she could not give me the address over the telephone. I was ordered instead to see Manny Blum, and to do so, I made my first visit to the district headquarters in over a year. For once, I found the voluble Manny silent. He would not even speak the address aloud to me in the office. Instead, he scribbled it on a piece of paper and handed it to me. It said, 33 Faiston Street, the home address of Otis Archer Hood. In the raw damp of a February evening, I picked my way over icy sidewalks, up darkened Faiston Street, to the duplex apartment building where Hood lived. The members of our class included young and old comrades, none of whom I knew. There were 4 college students, the wife of a successful Boston businessman, a young Greek photographer, and 2 Negroes. The meeting was held in a front room of the house, where Hood had arranged a large table spread with the supply of Marxist literature and surrounded by chairs. The first session was routine to establish the theme. We plunged into a study of value, price, and profit, with Hood as the instructor, emphasizing the contradictions in capitalism, which, he said, produce wars and recurring economic depressions. The teachings of the Lenin-Stalin Party, he told me, provide the knowledge of the laws of capitalist development and social struggle and furnish us with the assurance of ultimate victory. They teach us how to apply these laws in directing and leading the proletariat in the revolutionary struggle. Later in the course, in March, a storm broke over the heads of the party because of a statement by a French communist that his comrades would not participate with their nation in any war against the Soviet Union. It provoked long discussions in our classes. William Foster and Eugene Dennis issued a statement to the press in which they masterfully dodged the direct issue and still gave the proper line to disciplined communists by saying, "The United States communists will oppose a Wall Street war." In our secret meetings, this view was clarified.
Hood reminded us that the state is owned and controlled by capitalists, and that war is a necessary part of capitalist oppression. The question then was, what is true patriotism? The answer was that a true patriot was one who would fight on the side of the working people, and not on the side of the capitalist, who knows no patriotism and would sell out his country at any time for his own selfish interests. Therefore, Hood said, it was unthinkable that American communists should ever fight against the Soviet Union, the land of the working classes. If United States imperialists, he added, should insist upon creating such a war, then communists must do everything in their power to oppose the military operations of the country. In other words, any war the Communist Party chose thus to label would be a Wall Street war. Indirectly, through the Boston School for Marxist Studies, I learned that some of the methods of opposition would be below the ideological level. One of them was sabotage. The communists, recognizing that in the aftermath of a revolution, it would be necessary for them to restore a productive economy as quickly as possible, wisely planned to avoid wholesale destruction of valuable machinery through sabotage. They spelled out a policy of preserving irreplaceable machinery, which was regarded, after all, as the rightful property of the workers. Instead, the plan was to incapacitate temporarily entire plants and their crucial machines by knocking out power supplies, wrecking transmission lines, conduit cables, generators, transformers, any facility which would render productive machinery useless to the governing authorities, but leave it essentially intact to be restored immediately by the revolutionary forces. In concrete terms, they would not destroy rail locomotives and rolling stock, but would merely deny their use by ripping out the track. The saboteurs would strive for a complete paralysis rather than destruction of the critical points, bridges, dams, water supply lines, communications, etc. Otis Hood, in keeping with his usual demeanor, was very pleasant about the whole thing. After we have won the revolution, he said, destroyed the capitalist state, smashed the ruling power, and taken over the means of production, then we shall have a world without war, without oppression, without hunger, a world of peace. He spoke as if he believed it. The trial of the 11 now, with Chairman Foster excused for illness, opened in January. But it wasn't until March that Luis Badens, the former head of the Daily Worker, and a reformed ex-communist, took the stand as the first government witness. I made two trips directly to the United States Courthouse in New York to confer with attorneys close to the trial. These jaunts were still carefully guarded, but the procedure was changed. When I reached New York, I called the number furnished me and said, "This is Hubert Brooks." A voice on the other end of the line told me where to go and when. My identity was still a closely held secret, kept by the Bureau even from the top lawyers of the Justice Department. If anything should happen, and I should not be called for trial, the Bureau wanted to be sure that I could continue my membership in the Communist Party. I held a full day's conference with the United States Attorney, John F.X. McGoey. Mr. McGoey was scrupulous in his search for details. In his study, he had amassed a tremendous knowledge of Marxism-Leninism and had developed a remarkable appreciation for its devious course. It became more and more apparent that the government was building a large part of its case upon evidence that was in my possession, and that they would have to place me on the stand. But back in Boston, Daniel Boone Shermer called me one day and asked me to meet him for lunch at the Waldorf restaurant on Washington Street. Over our coffee, he began plying me with questions. "How are you coming on the new job?" he asked. "All right, I think. I have several other irons in the fire." "Do you expect to be traveling much?" "Some. A trip now and then." "Where?" "All over New England." "Will you use your own car or company car?" "Probably my own." "Will you have your weekends free?" "Yes." Then he glanced around and leaned toward me to make a point. "We need some reliable people for some special work. We need couriers to operate both in and out of the metropolitan district." "What about your neighbors? Are they suspicious of you?" "No one has ever given any indication of it." "Is there any room in your house for a temporary shelter?" I told him my little home was too crowded to take anyone in. "We need supply depots. Have you any storage space? I'm building a garage now. I can easily tack a shed on the rear of it." Boone was enthusiastic about the idea. We drew a plan for it on a paper napkin, an innocent-looking shed stuck on the garage, with a loading platform inside at the level of an automobile compartment. I actually started the construction according to the plan we roughed out, but the loading platform was never used for the intended purpose. Following my enigmatic luncheon conversation with Boone, I immediately flashed the FBI. I outlined what he had said, and I took the view that the courier proposition Boone had mentioned was most promising. "I still think I'd better stay in this thing where I can see what's going on. See if the government can't get someone else to testify," I pleaded. Don Richards promised that he would do all he could. But the government was all set. Riches brought back the information that I would be called to the stand, probably as soon as Bud Ends was finished. Have a suitcase packed and ready to go, Richards told me. Together we set up a plan of action. A series of code telephone calls was worked out between the Bureau and me. I typed out letters to a half dozen of my closest associates and relations. To Sam Pinansky, my boss at both M&P and American Theaters, and to the Reverend Ralph Berthoff, the minister at the First Baptist Church of Wakefield, to my sister Ruth, and my parents at Rye Beach, New Hampshire, and the others in my family. These letters were to explain in detail my long affiliation with the Communist Party and the FBI. They were sealed and prepared for mailing. Some were given to Edward Soucy, at that time special agent in charge of the Boston office of the FBI. They were to be mailed when I took the witness stand. Meanwhile, the Communist Party, while fighting a defensive rearguard battle in the trial of the top 11, continued its frontal propaganda attack against American foreign policy. Massive efforts were directed toward the organization of World Peace Conference, officially called the Cultural and Scientific Conference for World Peace, held at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City on March 25th through 27th. The purpose of the conference was to mobilize public opinion against the Marshall Plan and the North Atlantic Defense Pact, to undermine American foreign policy designed to contain communism and to curtail domestic spending for our military defense. Was Alexander Fadeyev, a Soviet hatchet man of Russian authors such as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who strayed from the approved communist line in literature. Although Fadeyev boasted the title of General Secretary of the Union of Soviet Writers, intelligence authorities here had reason to believe that his real job was that of a high official in the KGB, the Soviet secret police. Although I was invited to attend, it was decided, whether by the Bureau or someone in the Justice Department, I do not know, that we might be slicing things a little too thin with the date of my appearance, as a surprise witness, rapidly approaching. Still, I was sorry not to attend, since many of my Boston associates, communists and fellow travelers alike, were serving as sponsors of the World Peace Conference. But starkly noticeable in his absence was the name of Steve Fritchman, that I momentarily wondered if he too might appear as a government surprise witness in the case against the top 11. But the wheel of fortune determined otherwise. Fritchman, removed from the Boston area by his Unitarian supervisors, simply moved to the West Coast, where he began quickly establishing himself in a veritable beehive of communist activity. In Boston itself, the party went to work on another project. The CIO, United Office and Professional Workers of America, subsequently expelled from the CIO as communist tainted, started an organizing campaign among white-collar workers of the John Hancock Life Insurance Company, one of the key industries cited in our colonizing and party-building conference in 1947. The campaign to install the union as the bargaining agent of the employees was of paramount interest to the Communist Party. Orders came to my pro-group cell for every member to get behind the campaign. I was instructed by Carol Levy, a courier from the party district headquarters, to join the UOPWA and lend my efforts to the propaganda aspects of the drive. As a communist, therefore, I was installed in the union's campaign headquarters at 173 Milk Street near the Boston waterfront. I ground out questionnaires and flyers and assembled statistical material with which to attack the company and needle the Hancock employees into sentiments of discontent with their pay and working conditions. We attached coupons to all the flyers, by which the Hancock workers could give us name and address and authorize the union to serve as his bargaining agent. When the replies poured in from these flyers, my pro-group comrades got down to the grubbing level. They were used as drivers for union organizers and themselves were assigned to pay personal calls on workers at their homes to persuade them to cast their lot with the union. We were not to hold any mass meetings, but rather to conduct our recruiting as quietly and unobtrusively as possible. New members were told to keep their union affiliation secret, lest they lose their jobs. At first, the new union was organizing into cells, much the same as the Communist Party, and cell meetings were held regularly. But I didn't stay around to observe the successful conclusion of the John Hancock campaign. On Tuesday, April 5th, 1949, I had lunch with Carol Levy to brush up on the propaganda program. Shortly after I returned to the office, my telephone rang. Hello? I recognized the nasal accent of Don Richards. That printing job you ordered is ready. Can you pick it up about 5 o'clock? I'll be there, he said. The moment was at hand. Don's message told me, by prearranged code, that he would meet me at 5 and that I must be ready to go. I would probably go on the witness stand the next day. But I could not be sure. The way the trial was going, with endless objections and arguments by the defense staff, I might cool my heels for a week or more. Don instructed me beforehand to establish a good cover, in case I didn't come to work for several days. I feigned a bad cold and complained to Eddie Alfano that I wasn't feeling well. I planted the same impression with others in conversation with Bob Foster, the comptroller, over the moving of a filing cabinet in our office, and with a man in the booking department over the dates of a movie screening for advertising purposes. I let Mary Connors, our switchboard operator, know that I was feeling mighty low. Then, blowing my nose diligently, I told Eddie I was going home, rushed out of the office, and found Don Richards, my suitcase, in his car. Richards drove me straight to the airport. "You're still traveling incognito," he told me on the way. "Be careful, but once you get into the hands of Mr. McGoey, it will be all right to forget about security. You can tell them who you are. Fact is, you'll have to." I boarded the plane for New York. At LaGuardia Field, I called the blind telephone number and was told to proceed to the information booth at Grand Central Terminal. There I met a bureau agent whose name I did not know, but with whom I was by this time on friendly terms. He took me to an automobile parked on East 41st Street. Another agent sat behind the wheel. We drove through the evening traffic to Foley Square, and at the United States Courthouse, we ducked between iron gates into a ramp leading down into the building. Armed guards were posted at the entrance marked for official visitors. We entered a small elevator, which whisked us upward, in silence. When it stopped, one agent stayed with me in the car, while the other went ahead to see if the hallways were clear. I was hurried through corridors, past a door, which one of the agents held open, and which clicked on a spring lock when it closed after me. We went through a series of offices where the desks were all deserted. No one observed me. Finally, I entered a small inner room in which there were a few chairs, one blinded window, and a table stacked high with papers. The door opened and Mr. Shapiro stepped in. We exchanged greetings. "That's all your stuff," Shapiro said, indicating the large stacks of material on the table. "Quite a file. I didn't realize there was that much." Mr. Shapiro smiled. "That's only a small part of the truckload of reports you turned in." Mr. McGoey came to the room, together with Frank Gordon, the same Gordon who had won the antitrust case against Paramount. "This is a fine thing," I said, greeting him. "First you eased me out of a job, and now you're going to give me the third degree?" I expected Mr. McGoey and his staff to run through my testimony again, and I was keyed with excitement. But instead, the prosecutor placed me entirely at ease, sitting and chatting informally for over an hour. He barely touched on the trial, except to ask me a few questions about my identity, my real name, where I lived, my schooling, and my business experience, enough to round out the preliminary testimony I was to give. The two FBI agents who came with me remained through the conference, one of them in the room and the other just outside the door. Afterward, the two took me in a car to a restaurant for a late dinner. I got to know the FBI man as Jim Johns and Jack Parsons. With both of them constantly at my side, we drove to a small hotel on a quiet street. I never did know the name of it. In the tiny lobby, the two agents stood aside, one by the door and the other by the elevator, while I stepped to the desk to register as Hubert Brooks of the Ace Advertising Agency, Boston. In a little single room on an upper floor, Jack instructed me, "I don't want you to open the door or use the telephone until we call for you tomorrow morning. Bolt the door and keep it bolted. Anything else is okay," he said with a grin. "Take it easy." As I stood forlornly in the middle of the room, the two agents walked out. I locked the door behind them and went to bed to pass a sleepless night. The following day, my bodyguards were on hand for an early breakfast. Then I was smuggled in the cellular ramp to the federal building and spirited again to the secluded room on the upper floor, where the vigil of waiting began. At about 11 o'clock, Jack beckoned to me. Feeling light on my feet, my heart pounding in my throat, I was taken to a small elevator and dropped to the courtroom floor. For almost an hour, I stood in the darkened elevator. Through the open door, I could glimpse a corner of the courtroom and the bailiff stand. My mouth was dry. At noon, the call turned into a false alarm. The court recessed for lunch, and I was whisked back to my chamber above. Luncheon was brought to me. Shortly before 2 o'clock, I was taken to the courtroom floor once more. This time, I had not long to wait. There were some preliminary arguments in the courtroom. I glanced at my watch. It was almost 2:05. There was an eerie silence in the blacked-out elevator. I wondered what the reaction would be in Boston. In the midst of my reverie, I had heard the voice of Mr. McGoey. Mr. Bailiff, will you call Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick? So it's finally here, and he's about to testify. Real quick, one thing that jumped out at me in this chapter was when he was in another one of these communist classes, and Otis Hood says, "After we have won the revolution, destroyed the capitalist state, smashed the ruling power, and taken over the means of production, then we shall have a world without war, without opposition, without hunger, a world of peace." And he spoke as if he believed it. I think it's clear a lot of them do. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode. Thank you for listening. Remember, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.